I'd like to introduce someone who is a very good friend, Professor Julius Lippner from Cambridge, although originally from Calcutta. And who has been a professor in Cambridge in the Divinity Faculty teaching Hindu studies, pioneered the field of Hindu studies in Cambridge, and is a senior fellow of the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies. At the same time, we're very honoured about that, and very happy that he can come and talk to us today. It's about the Bhagavad Gita, and it's about interpretation of the Gita. How is it done? And particularly looking at the two acharyas, Sankaracharya and Ramanujacharya. So, always a lively presentation. He's taken his tie off.
Yeah, that shows you I mean business.
Not Thank God he can't roll up his sleeves.
Yeah.
Okay,
thank you very much. By now you have all heard Chanukya's jokes, so
he's softened you up for this session. I was asked to talk on the Gita, Bhagavad Gita. There are other Gitas, maybe one or two sitting around this table also. But the Bhagavad Gita interpretation and truth. And then I put in bracket with reference to Shankara and Ramanuja. And I really want to talk about the possibility or impossibility of being able to say, I know what this text means. Now, you can read a text and you can derive meaning from it. Or you can go to a guru and the guru will say, this is what the text means. And I just want to shake that up a bit to show you that there are other ways of looking at a text, whether it is a religious text or a non-religious text. What is going on in the production of a text and in the launching of a text into the public forum? Now, all of you are intelligent people. All of you have experience of life. All of you know that words can be interpreted, misinterpreted, understood, misunderstood. All of you know that there are gaps in meaning. Why should it be different for a text? We live in an age, especially after Brexit, we live in an age of tremendous uncertainty. And when people speak about the rise of fundamentalism, they're really talking about a way of trying to reduce uncertainty, moral uncertainty, religious uncertainty, other kinds of uncertainty, in a sea of crashing waves and trouble and changes and globalization, which we find very difficult to cope with. So we have to know how to negotiate texts in a way that helps us to be mature understanders and readers of a text. And I've chosen the Bhagavad Gita because it's a very central text in what we call Hinduism. Hinduism is an umbrella term, as you know, for a whole list and a whole series of different kinds of sects and cults and faith responses and denominations and so on. And yet the Gita has, though ostensibly it's a Vaishnava text, the Gita has occupied a very important role from certainly the first millennium of the common era, the Christian era. Within the Hindu tradition, it became more universal, it became more outward-looking, Western-centric, only from about the 18th century. Before that, it was not known outside the subcontinent. But within the subcontinent, it's always been a very important text. But mainly for Vaishnavas, because we're talking about Krishna, who says he is Vishnu in one place or two. So I've given you a handout there and I'll take you through that, but these are just points which I'll talk to. Now, you can date a text if it does not say give its own date. You can date a text from the kind of language that it uses. Gita is in Sanskrit, as you know. So from the kind of language, the kind of Sanskrit, and also the style of the Sanskrit. And I think now it is fairly agreed by scholars, those who actually look at style of language, development of language, and so on. The Gita is about the first century of the Common Era. So you will still read in the books the Gita, even previous scholarly books, Gita's 5th century BCE, before the Common Era, or 2nd century BCE, well, give or take 100 years, 100 BCE to 200 CE. That's from the style of the Sanskrit. And it consists of 18 adhyayas, or chapters, 700 verses. There are some extra verses and some different versions of the Gita, but generally Shankara and Ramanuja talk of 700. So a received tradition of 700 verses. It occurs, as you know, in the Mahabharata and in the Bhishma Parvan of the Mahabharata, which is book 6. How many Parvans are there in the Mahabharata? How many books in the Mahabharata? 18. Okay, so this is in book 6 of the Mahabharata. And there has been a dispute as to whether it was interposed in the Mahabharata, written outside, composed outside, and then inserted in the Mahabharata, because Mahabharata is a developing text, right? It took about 500 years to have the form in which it has now. There are some scholars who think that most of it, or the core of it, was written by one or two pundits, but scholars generally believe that it just grew by accretion. There may have been a core story. But normally the dates of the Mahabharata are 400 BC to 400 or 200 AD CE. So the Mahabharata developed over time in different layers and so on. Some say the Gita was interposed, inserted, written outside. Some say, no, it came within the Mahabharata. And I think that debate is still going on. But a well-known scholar says the Bhagavad Gita was conceived, created in the context of the Mahabharata. It was not an independent text that somehow wandered into the epic. So I won't go to the stake for one position or the other. But I think myself, I would tend to agree that it is part of the original story of the Mahabharata, the Bhagavad Gita. So already you are beginning to see that these important texts have a history, and that you can't proclaim without dissension or without some kind of argument, even on such basic things as context, date, and so on. Now, you know the story of the Mahabharata in essence, right? You have two sides, Pandavas, Kauravas. And they engage in a huge war, because the Pandavas were cheated out of their territory. Krishna goes to both sides because they are related. And I grew up in India. My mother is still alive, 95. She is Indian. We know what relatives mean in the Indian context. We love them and hate them at the same time. They are in everything. Their fingers are everywhere and so on. They meddle and so on. But they are our relatives, and when the time comes, we stick by each other. So Krishna went to both sides and said, okay, you guys have a choice. He asked the oldest of the Kauravas, Duryodhana. He said, you have a choice between me and my army. And Duryodhana was a man whose buddhi, whose intelligence was clouded by tamas, by darkness. And he only looked at the numerical figures and so on. He knew Krishna was extraordinary, even divine. But yeah, I want your army. I'm going to have a battle, right? Let's be practical about these things. Because Krishna said you will be a non-combatant. Who wants Krishna as a non-combatant when I can have his army who will fight on my side? And Arjuna and Yudhishthira said, okay, we will have Krishna. We're happy to have Krishna on our side. Krishna was therefore the charioteer of Arjuna. Savyasachi. Arjuna. Savyasachi means someone who can fire a bow with left hand or right hand with equal skill and facility. Savyasachi, that is Arjuna. So Krishna said, I will be your charioteer. So he takes a humble role. He takes an instrumental role on the face of it during this great battle between the two sides on the field of, where was the battle?
Kurukshetra.
Exactly. So then the battle is about to begin and the two sides are arrayed against each other. It's a magnificent scene, you can picture it. And already some are firing arrows. If you saw Lord of the Rings, and you have the orcs and so on one side and the good guys on the other side, and they're all facing each other. Some guys are already releasing arrows in order to defy and to show that we are ready to come and get you. The same thing is happening on the battlefield there. And all the trumpets and the blasts and so on are taking place. At that time, Krishna decides to talk to his Sarathi, his companion, in Sanskrit verse? No. So obviously it is not a literal situation. It is symbolic already there. How at the beginning of a battle for 18 adhyayas and 18 chapters this speech is given in Sanskrit verse? It should be in the Prakrit, it should be in everyday language. So it is the Gita, it is a song. It is a polished message that has been given by the avatarin who has come down to speak to us. And therefore it is polished in terms of Samskrita. Samskrita in Sanskrit means polished, refined. That's where we get the English word, anglicized form, Sanskrit. Sanskrit comes from Samskrita. Samskrita means polished or refined. It's a refined language. And I tell all my colleagues in Cambridge, you may be teaching Greek and Arabic and so on, but in heaven you will speak Sanskrit. They're not entirely convinced. I said, no, in an antechamber of heaven you can talk your Greek and Arabic and Latin, but once you get through the doors into heaven, you will have to talk Sanskrit. But don't worry, because we're all born with the facility to learn Sanskrit. It's only tamas and avidya that is blocking our knowledge of Sanskrit. So in heaven you will have no avidya and tamas, so you'll be able to talk Sanskrit quite easily. So it's in this language. It is a Gita. It is the song of the Lord. Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavan's song. Bhagavan is a Vaishnava word for God. It's not really a Shaiva word. It is a Vaishnava word for God. Bhagavan. It is more used by those in Vaishnava traditions. So the Bhagavad Gita is a song of the Lord. And in fact, lots of stuff was going on round about the beginning of the Common Era when the Gita was produced. Lots of stuff in the social and the intellectual world of that time. Buddhism had already come 300-400 years before the Buddha had come. So Buddhism was gaining power and force. There are traces of Buddhism in the Gita. Sankhya and Yoga had already been established. Pancharatra, which is a Vaishnava form of approach to God, had already begun in the various regions. Nyaya Vaisheshika, the great logical and metaphysical schools, had got off the ground. The idea of karma and rebirth was gaining quite strong ground by this time. What was quite new was the notion of avatara. That is quite new to the Gita. And the Gita is one of the earliest texts that gives the notion of avatara. The descent, avatri, avatarati, come down from heaven, the descent of the Supreme Being into human affairs. That was quite a new teaching of the Gita. So all this, and then the Vedic sacrifice was quite strong. The Mimamsakas who said, the most important thing is to perform the yajna, or the sacrifice, and to appease the gods and so on, and to get the seasons in due order and the crops and everything, but you only do it through yajna. That, whether there is a Brahman or not, we don't know. The Upanishads had already been written who said there is a Brahman, a real being. And the Purva Mimamsakas, who opposed them, intellectually said, who cares? Who knows? Can't see, can't touch. What we can see and touch is the harvest and so on, and that is done through the yajna. All this stuff was going on at the time of the Gita. And what the Gita does, quite brilliantly, it's not a philosophical text. If by philosophy you mean what Westerners mean by philosophy. Clear, precise use of language through argumentation and so on. Some Westerners have said, oh, the Gita has got all sorts of mixed up. Ill-assorted cabinet of philosophical beliefs. You know, you have cabinets where you put one ivory tusk here, one Dresden figure here. They all don't necessarily go together. So they said, these things don't. That's not what the Gita intends to do. The Gita is not a philosophical text. The Gita gives a message, bringing together all these different schools of thought and giving them some kind of synthesis in such a way that it claims to bring to a head the teaching of the Veda through Krishna. Krishna says, I am the Samaveda, I am the Rig Veda, I am the Yajur Veda, I am Om. Omkara in the Veda. I am therefore the essence of the Veda. He's not repudiating the Veda. He's summing it up. He's saying, I am the fulfillment of the Veda. He says it 3-4 times in the Gita. So the Gita does not repudiate. The Gita takes on board, absorbs and supersedes all these teachings and synthesizes them. In that sense, it's a brilliant message. Because it makes sense of all the conflicting intellectual ferment that's going on around it in terms of bhakti, devotion to Krishna as the Supreme Being. And there it is, ekantin, one-pointed. That's the beauty of the Gita. And it incorporates karma yoga, mimamsakas, by karma, the yajna, the action. That's how you're going to live the next day and survive in this hard, harsh way. We're talking about 2,500 years ago. You could not control, can't control the world now with all the weather and all this stuff. What's happening 2,500 years ago? So the yajna helps to control the world, keeping the harvest, the seasons, the sun and the moon in the heavens and so on and so forth. It's through the yajna. In 1963, some pandits and astrologers said that a planet was going to come in India, planet is going to come and crash on the earth and destroy India. You should have seen all the yajnas and so on taking place to offset this in our desh, in Bharat Mata. Oh! And the date came and nothing happened. Because the yajna worked. Yajna worked. So that was the aim of the yajna, they're very powerful. So karma yoga, the yoga, the harvesting, the marshalling of action, jnana yoga, you had therefore the Upanishadic tradition where it was through jnana or knowledge that you could achieve insight and liberation. And then the Gita combines this, blends it, makes it ekantin, powerful through bhakti yoga. That is through devotion. And you can't have devotion to anything, you have devotion to a personal being, Krishna. So, on the face of it, ostensibly, the Gita is a devotional, theistic, theos, God, dualistic, God and us, infinite and finite, text. Okay? And At that time, a big debate was just getting off the ground between the Purva Mimamsakas, those who say karma is most important, the yajna is most important, and the Vedantins or Uttara Mimamsakas, those who say jnana is important. In order to rest, in order to conquer the intellectual world of that time, because they had to also fight against Buddhism and Jainism, not to mention the other schools that were around, Ajivikas and so on. So big debate was going on, and they established three sources, Prasthana Trayi, three foundations of this, the Vedantic side, the three sources, the Brahma Sutras, written about that time, which were in verse, sutra, a verse. We get the English word sutra. All the medics among you, it's cognate language, sutra, that which stitches together some ideas and thoughts from same root of sutra. You have then the Upanishads, the Vedanta, the end of the Veda, the traditional Upanishad, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, Chandogya Upanishad, so on and so forth, about 12, 13, 14, and the Bhagavad Gita, Prasthana Trayi. These three are the sources of the Vedantic tradition which would eventually conquer over the Purva Mimamsakas, who said, only through karma can you go forward. Whether Brahman exists or not, who knows? Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma, Taittiriya Upanishad. Brahman is Satyam, being. Jnanam, knowledge. Anantam, infinite. Can I see Brahman? I cannot see the Supreme. We are living here and now. The Vedantin said, no. There is a supreme reality underlying all this differentiation. The millions and millions of individuals of this world and all the differentiation of this world, trees, animals, and so on. Underlying it is Brahman, a supreme reality out of which it all comes, to which it all goes back. And where our ultimate destiny is. Of course, the karma is so important. Of course we need harvests and so on and so on. Not rejecting. Hindus don't reject. Hindus incorporate. They use other traditions as stepping stones very often. But they don't say it's all a tissue of lies and errors and so on, you all go to hell. No, sometimes they do. But mostly they don't. Mostly they don't. And anyway, hell in Hinduism is not, Naraka is not permanent. You fulfill your bad karma and you come out of it. There's a big difference with the Abrahamic traditions. So, yes, the Vedantin said there is Brahman. There is this reality underlying everything, which is our destiny. And some said this reality is personal, some said this reality is impersonal. Among the Vedantin camp, Shankara impersonal, Ramanuja personal. Shankara's days, 8th century, Adi Shankara. Don't believe those old pundits who say Adi Shankara's 2000 BC and all that. No. 8th century of the common era. Ramanuja, 11th to 12th century. Okay, now we'll come to that. But what I'm trying to do is give you the context of the Gita and say what the Gita is trying to do. Now, for the Vedantins, Shankara and Ramanuja, the same Gita is one of the Prasthana Trayi, the three foundations of source material to establish their position. And one is an Advaitin, which I'll explain, and one is a Vishishta Advaitin, which I'll explain. One goes for an impersonal Brahman, one goes for a personal Brahman, who has a name, Vishnu Narayana. And they both look at the Gita and say, this supports my position. So now we are going to talk a bit about the text, what the text is. So if you look at point 2, I've just finished with point 1. If you look at point 2, the nature of text. So when I look at the Gita, when I read a text, when I read the Mahabharata, when I read Shakespeare, when I read some great text, the meaning of the text, is it a given? Does the author bestow a meaning on it? Especially, we're not talking about instruction manuals, how to do your washing machine and so on. That is a text, but we're not talking of text at that level. We're talking about literary text. Is there a given meaning to the text that the author, whose the author's intention is in it? Or is there not? That is the big question. The formalists say there is a given meaning. So if you read Shakespeare, if you read Mahabharata, if you read Kalidasa, the meaning is already given in the text. And what is your job is to access it. As a reader, you access the text. You derive, you unearth that meaning. The non-formalists say, no, that's an illusion. Because why do you have the same text and you've got Shankara and Ramanuja both with different positions appealing to the same text? Where's the given meaning? And I'll give you an example of how they use the same text, the Gita, and Shankara proves that this is an Advaitic interpretation, and Ramanuja says the wish is like a personal interpretation. Same text, same words. We've all experienced that to some extent. So the formalists say, no, the meaning is bestowed by the author. The non-formalists say the meaning of the text is created by interaction between reader and author, reader and text. And they say, look at the Quran, even the Quran. The Quran is supposed to be direct communication in Arabic within one lifetime, 22 years, to one human being, Prophet Muhammad, by the Almighty Allah. That is the Quran. The Bible has got so many books, took hundreds of years to develop. The Vedas and Upanishads took hundreds of years to develop. But the Quran was written, or not written, was spoken in one lifetime of one human being. Sort of divine ventriloquism. What the Prophet Muhammad did was just to repeat what the Almighty said to him. And yet, if you study Muslim interpretation, you will see so many different, Quran is quite a substantial book, so many different interpretations of the same text, the Quran. Even there, so many different interpretations. That's why you've got the Shias, you've got the Sunnis, you've got different groups among the Sunnis. That in the Quran, that one text given to one man in 22 years, the scholars say some of those words are superseded by later texts of the same text, and so on and so forth. So even the Quran has multiple interpretations. What more? Texts like these. So the non-formalists say, only when a community reads it, and we know that from all religious communities, ISKCON and so on and so forth, they will read the Bhagavata Purana, and the guru is teaching, and they say, this is what the text means. The same text is taken by another group. He will read the thing and say, no, it means something else. See, the words say something else. We are creating the meaning of the text as we go along. And if you agree with me, then that is the meaning for us. So what about their meaning, which is a bit different? That is their meaning of the same text. This is our meaning of the same text. And I'll show you a little later on how it is done. And during the discussion, we shall see what you think about it. How can the same text yield different meanings? Isn't it clear? This is not an Advaitic text. There's a personal being who comes down as an avatar who says, I. Advaita says we are all ekam, one. Aham and ekam. Which is the right interpretation of this text. The non-formalists say, you see, we create meaning as we go along. We interrelate as a community, and our community says this is the meaning of the text, that is the meaning for us. Your community says that's the meaning for you. Both meanings can be valid. Where is truth? If we operate, they say, with one childish, mechanical, mathematical notion of truth, we are impoverished as human beings. 2 and 2 is 4, 8 and 8 is 16, and so on and so forth. Is that your model of truth? Must everything conform to that model to be called true? Is the scientific or scientist model of truth only form of truth? My friend loves me. How do you know your friend loves you? Where is 2 and 2 is 4 and 8 and 8 is 16? My friend loves me. My husband loves me, my wife loves me. My daughter loves me, I love my son. Is that true or false? Can you use the word true for such statements? Where's the proof? If you cannot say these statements are true, what a miserable life we lead. So there are different models, there are different forms of truth. And what we are doing in this age of science, we are forcing ourselves, allowing ourselves to be slaves to a mechanical model of truth. There is only one model of truth, and that is a scientific mathematical model. No. I know my wife loves me. By the quality of her life. I know my son loves me. I know I love my son. But I can't prove it in the way I prove that 6 and 6 is 12. So there are different models of truth that we must operate in terms of. And what is the truth of the Gita? I hope all these things will come up in discussion when we are talking about truth and ambiguity. Okay, so now, if you look at your handout, please, because we should have some time for discussion. We are on to number 3A. The position of Shankara, so that you can appreciate how both of them look at this, approach the same text and get different meanings out of it. And at the end of that exercise, which is an exercise, we will say, but can you still say one is right and one is wrong? Are you a formalist or non-formalist in your understanding of text? Is the text given? Has it a given meaning? Or do you create meaning? Or is it somewhere in between? So, Shankara, 8th century, Advaitin. What does Advaita mean? Advaita. Advaita means?
Absence of duality.
Advaita means, Advaita means duality.
No,
Advaita means absence of duality. A in Sanskrit can have different senses. It can mean non something, absence of, which is, I think, a good way of putting it. Absence of as opposed to against. Like we use the word amoral and immoral, right, in English. To say someone is amoral means that they are neither moral nor immoral. To say someone is immoral, bad guy. Right? In Sanskrit, a has the same kind of meaning. I'm an abrahmana. He's a bad Brahmin. But advaita means absence. So that a can have both these kinds of meaning as in English, a and im. So, Brahman for Shankaracharya is one without a second. Ekam eva advitiyam. One without a second. One without a second is another way of him saying unique. 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 You can have one without a second that is not really unique. You can have the last tiger in this world. God forbid that we ever come to that stage. You know, there are more tigers in captivity than in the wild. That's a separate issue. More tigers in America in captivity than there are in the wild. Leave alone other parts of the world. But that's a separate issue. But you can have the last tiger in the world. That is ekam, not in this sense. Because there were so many tigers. And if we develop techniques like we did in Jurassic Park, to recreate the dinosaurs, we can get tigers back again. But Brahman is ekameva dvitiyam in the sense that there cannot be another Brahman through the nature of Brahman. It is unique by nature, not by contingency or by species or gender or something. Okay, that's for Shankara. Now he distinguishes between the highest Brahman, Param Brahma, and Aparam Brahma, the lower Brahman. So he says, you have this Brahman that the Upanishads teach. This Brahman underlies the whole world. You cannot see or touch. Asprishya cannot be touched. Drishya cannot be seen. Cannot be heard. Etc. 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 But it exists because you can experience it. And that is the source of everything and the goal of everything. The one Brahman. And that is what the Upanishads and the Gita also teaches. Okay, so where does Krishna go? Where do we all go? The Gita is saying, apparently, from what I said, Krishna is the avatara, we have to worship him, bhakti yoga, so that's two. Dualism, not Advaita, that's Dvaita. Tuism, but not for Shankara. I'll show you how he comes to that conclusion. So he says, yes, there is an Aparam Brahma, Supreme Brahman, which you cannot see, touch. That Brahman we perceive in our limited way, with our limited intellect, we perceive as conditioned and so on. We call it Ishvara, we call it God. Because we cannot, in this stage of avidya or ignorance, perceive Brahman in its true nature. So we condition it by upadhis, by qualities, by attributes. And we say, this is Ishvara, the creator of the world. As soon as you use this language, you are in Dvaita speech. World, difference, Brahman, us, etc., etc. That's the only way we can speak. That's the only way we can think. We are finite beings. And the more you go through into yourself, the more you do your dhyana or meditation, the more you get into your deepest Atman or being, the more all this difference melts away like mist in the noonday sun. Try it and see, he says. You are so steeped now in this material world, you say, well, it's an impossible goal. No. Rishis have done it. So many sages have done it. The more you meditate and go into the depths, the more all this differentiation becomes more and more transparent. And you get deeper shanti or peace. And you go deeper into yourself. And you see how everything is really one. And we have inklings of this in our world. When all people sing together, so many different people make common cause and produce one beautiful tune or music. All the different things produce one result. See, we even appreciate that. Now, if you have this meditation, you will see that we are all reflections of this one Brahman. Like a pot of water reflects the sun, a lake reflects the same sun, muddy water reflects it. How many suns are there? Thousand suns? No. One sun reflected in lots of different mediums. Or you look at yourself in a mirror. So many different mirrors. You can see thousands of images, one behind you. How many of you are there? One. But all these reflections are multiple. Similarly, there's one Brahman reflected in different mirrors of existence. And seeing you, when you look through that, and the rishis have done it, there's your proof. You will see there is only one. Ekameva Dvitiyam. So we say Param Brahma, highest Brahman is that, but Aparam, lower Brahman, is the Brahman that we worship in the temples, and you have murtis of it, and pictures of it, and statues of it, and images of it. That one Brahman is being reflected in all these different murtis, and all these different temples, in Vishnu, and Shiva, and Kali, and Chamunda, Chamundi, whatever. And the texts themselves say, Kali is a reflection of Durga. And all the goddesses, Mahavidyas, are a reflection of Kali. This is how Hindus think. This is my great thing of polycentrism. Lots of different centers coming from one source. So, does the Hindu text talk this way? So, that is Shankara's position. Then he speaks of the God as Saguna Nirguna. What does guna mean?
Quality.
So when you are in your finite mode, when you have not reached the depth of your consciousness or proper thinking or being, then you attribute, you stick, you label different gunas on Brahman. And you say this is Krishna, who's Brahman, this is Vishnu, this is Shiva. Then you have all these arguments, disagreements, so on and so forth. That is Brahman Saguna, creatorship. Creatorship is Dvaita language. Destroyer, Dvaita language. Because there must be differentiation for you to create and to destroy. This is Brahman Saguna. And Nirguna, the moment you keep shedding all these qualities through meditation and realization, and you have only one Brahman. So that is Shankara's position, okay? Now I'll give you Ramanuja's position, and then we'll look at this text of the Gita, and then we'll have a discussion. Ramanuja came 3 centuries after Shankara. Ramanuja is in the Pancharatra tradition, which is a personal Dvaita tradition. He said in his great commentary on the Brahma Sutras, Ramanuja, anyone who follows Shankara, Sarpati Eva, will slink away like a snake from this kind of Advaitic vision. Which human being wants this kind of Advaitic vision in this world? We need a God. We need Dvaita. We need to worship God. It is not only a psychological need, it's also a reality. And that was his Pancharatrik tradition coming to the fore. So that's what the Vedas teach. There is a Brahman underlying everything. But this Brahman is personal, Paurusheya, Purusha, personal. This Brahman has created the world, Shrashtri, he's a creator. This Brahman has come down as an avatarin to save us. This Brahman has a name, Vishnu Narayana. Yeah, but some say Shiva, they're all wrong. But even they're at least right in saying that it has a name, that this is personal God. Only they're not worshipping. Shiva is another form of Vishnu Narayana. They don't understand it. And those guys say, no, Vishnu Narayana is another form of Shiva, but doesn't matter. At least they both agree to a personal supreme being. This is a Vishishta Advaita. He says, so there is Advaita, there is non-duality, because all of us depend on Brahman for existence. In that sense, we are his body. Just as our body depends on our Atman for existence, we all, including our individual Atmans, depend on Brahman for existence. So in that sense, we are Brahman's body, Vishishta Advaita. It is the Advaita, the non-duality of Vishishta, of all different things depending on Brahman. But Brahman is personal. Brahman has a name. Brahman is Ishvara. Saguna, Nirguna doesn't make any sense. Paramaparam doesn't make any sense. There is only one supreme being, personal being, full of compassion, karuna, full of love, infinitely blissful, infinite existence, all-powerful and so on and so forth. Very similar to the Abrahamic faiths. In some respects. And that's what the Gita says. Okay, so now you've got Shankara, who's an Advaitin. Now you've got Ramanuja, who's a believer in a personal God, who's a Vishishta Advaitin. Incompatible, these two. They fought now. They didn't literally know, because one is 300 years before the other. But their successors fought tremendously in debate and discussion. Don't believe for a second that Hindus are all peaceful, tolerant, and there's huge... That is why Amartya Sen could write argumentative Indian. Yeah. And we all know we are argumentative by nature. God has put an argumentative gene in our systems. How much argument goes on among Indian families, nobody's business, but that's okay. So, they are real followers of truth and reason. And tolerance is... a bit of a myth in Indian tradition. It's a 19th century idea, mainly with the Ramakrishnaites and so on. All parts lead in the same way. You take the high road, I take the road, we'll all go to heaven together. It's only a 19th century idea in Hinduism through the Ramakrishna order mainly. Basically, the whole tradition of Hinduism shows huge debate, huge discussions in the search for truth, search for reason, search for logic. And with not only among Hindus, but among Buddhists, with Jainas, and so on and so forth. And I think a good thing. Because it shows that Hindus are keen to actually seek out what is right as opposed to what is wrong. Okay, so now let us look at this text of the Gita, which I've written over here for you, but which I'll put on this board, because right now it is virgin territory. I want to spoil at least one paper. This is Gita 13.12. Gita 13.12. And the text says, Niyam Yat Tat Tat Pravakshyami. Yajnyatva
there you have very important wit, anadi mat. Param. I think Brahma. That's the word Brahma. Nasaptam. Nasa Dichate. Okay, now this is just one verse in the Gita, but a very important verse. And you will see how Shankara interprets it, how Ramanuja interprets it. Shankara will come out with an Advaitic interpretation. Ramanuja will come out with a Vishishtadvaitic interpretation. Totally incompatible. And you will see now how a text is ambiguous. Is the meaning given or is the meaning created? That is the original question. Alright. Now, I will give you the translation. Neyam yatta pravakshyami. Pravakshyami, I will tell. Who is speaking?
Krishna.
Pravakshyami, I will, future tense, I will tell you neyam, that which should be known. Yat, tat, that which should be known, tat pravakshyami, that I will tell you. Krishna saying to Arjuna, that which should be known, I will tell you. Very important, because it should be known, neyam, to be known. I will tell you. Yad nyatva, which having known, nyatva, past participle, which having known, ashnute, one attains, one gains, amritam. What's amritam?
Purity. Immortality.
Immortality. Immortality. And now, anadi mat param brahma. Brahma is?
Now, indestructible.
This is where the problem arises. The last sentence, uchyate, that immortal, that niyam, that amritam, that Brahma, uchyate, is said to be nasat, not being, nasat, not non-being. So it's a very important text. I will tell you that which you should know, and which when you know, you will gain immortality, but that which I'm going to tell you should is Brahman. It's neither being nor non-being. Okay. Now, all texts are ambiguous to some extent, but Sanskrit texts are more ambiguous than most other texts because of the nature of the Sanskrit language. Sanskrit is a language in which samasa, words are run together. Okay? We have it also as a relic in English. Oven ready. The food is oven ready. We are running two words together. Oven ready. Does that mean it's ready from the oven or ready for the oven? Garage owner. Do you own one garage or more garages? So we have many of these words which we run together which are ambiguous, even in most languages. German, a lot. But Sanskrit par excellence. Sanskrit, you can have one whole sentence made of 22 words run together. And in fact, some older poets wrote long poems summarizing the story of the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. If you broke up the words in one day, that is the Ramayana. And if you broke up the words in another way, that's the Mahabharata. So in the same string of words, you can read the Ramayana or you can read the story of the Mahabharata. Fantastic. A Sanskrit can only do that. And here is the problem. Anadi mat param brahma. Brahma is by itself. Brahman is anadi. What does anadi mean? Beginningless. Mat is a suffix which you can add to anadi or you can add to param. So Shankara says anadi mat Shankara says, anadi matparam brahma. So, I will now show you how each of them reads the text. They have no disagreement with this. I will tell you that which is to be known, which once you know it, you will achieve immortality. Well, they do disagree, but I'll come up on that. Now, Shankara says, how do you read this? Do you read this anadi mat param brahma? Or do you read it anadi mat param brahma? The Sanskrit can take both interpretations. And Shankara says, this is how you must read it. This is what we'll discuss. On what grounds can he say this? Shankara says, if you say anadi mat param brahma, there is some grounds for it. Anadi, separate, mat param brahma. Brahman is anadi, beginningless. Mat param, mat is a form of saying I, aham. Param means highest. So, Brahma is, I am higher than Brahma. Brahman is beginningless, I am higher than Brahma. Krishna is saying this. Krishna is saying, Brahman is beginningless, Brahman is not the supreme Brahman, I am the supreme Brahman, I am higher than Brahman. If Shankara takes this reading, gone is Advaita. Right? Because if Krishna is higher than Brahman, then Krishna, personal God, is the teaching of the Gita. Shankara says, actually, you should take it in this way. Anadimat param Brahman. The highest Brahman is Anadimat. And here, mat does not mean I. And mat means an addition to the word anadi, just to make it, make the meter, because this is in verse, full. So, anadimat param Brahman. Param Brahman is beginningless. Then there's no problem. So, by reading the text differently, and we all read texts in this way, even English texts, German texts, Hindi texts, by reading the text differently, Shankara comes up with an interpretation which says, the highest Brahman, Param Brahma, is anadimat, is beginningless. It is neither being nor non-being. Na saktan, it is neither being nor non-being. That makes sense? Because it is not like a ghata. What is a ghata? A jar, a pot made of clay. A pot can be either beginningless, can have a beginning or no beginning. You see it there, this glass exists for a long time. Okay, but or you can break it. You can talk about ordinary objects as if it has a beginning or no beginning. But Brahman has neither beginning nor non-beginning. It's neither existent or non-existent. This thing, if I melt it, it is asat, non-existent. And if I make it in the factory, it is sat, existent. Ordinary objects like you and me, that the world is full of, can be sat or asat. Brahman is neither sat nor asat because it is not an ordinary object. It is ekameva dvitiyam. It is not like the last tiger. It belongs in a complete different category of being. And that's what the Upanishad is saying. So it is supporting my Advaitic view. You understand that? That is what Shankara, how Shankara interprets it. So Krishna is saying, that which is to be known, Brahma, the Param Brahma, Pravakshami, I will tell you. That Param Brahma is anadi, beginningless. It is immortal, amritam. It is neither existent nor non-existent, because it is ekam eva dvitiyam. It is absolutely unique. See, isn't that Advaitic text? Now Ramanuja comes on the scene. And he says, what is tat? Shankara is assuming that tat is the supreme Brahman. Actually, Krishna is talking about the pratyagatma, the individual self, the real self inside each one of us, the true self. That true self, the Gita also calls Brahma. And he says, look at Gita 14:27.
I lugged this book all the way from Cambridge. I better open it once at least. Gita 14:27. Gita 14:27. Brahmano hi pratishtha aham. I am the foundation of Brahman. Brahman. Krishna's talking. Amritasya vyayasya cha, of the immortal and the imperishable. I am the foundation, says Krishna in 14:27. Shasvatasya cha dharmasya, and of all eternal dharma. Shukhasya ekantikasya cha, and of bliss absolute. So, Krishna is saying, I am the foundation of Brahman, of the immortal and the imperishable, of everlasting virtue and absolute bliss. Brahman here, Krishna is the foundation of Brahman, is of yourself. How does yourself exist? By its own power? No. Krishna is the pratishtha, the foundation of all ourselves. We come out of Krishna. So the Gita in 14:27 is using Brahma for the true self, not for the Supreme Brahman. It's doing that here also. See how he is interpreting the text to get a Vishishtadvaitic interpretation. Same text. How can you say this is what the Gita teaches? Shankara teaches or Ramanuja is right? Who's right? I want you to understand how texts are ambiguous. So that you understand that the people who don't accept your view are neither mad nor bad. That has been the traditional view. They are in error, they are fools, they are either mad, means they can't see what I see in that sense, or bad. They don't want to see the truth. And it's so easy for us to disregard the other in those terms. And here you have two great Vedantins, both are Vedantins, one an Advaitin Vedantin and one a Vishishadvaitin, using the same text to come to incompatible conclusions. And they're both great Acharyas. Neither is mad nor bad. This is what a text does. It is ambiguous. So Ramanuja is saying, I will tell you about that Brahman, which really is the individual self, not the Supreme Brahman. Gita itself is said it in 14:27. Knowing which, you becomes immortal. And he says, anadi mat param brahma. So this is how Ramanuja takes it. He stops with anadi and he takes it as mat param brahma. And I, Krishna, am the superior to this individual Brahman. So this individual Brahman is neither being nor not being. So how can the individual self be neither being nor not being? I can understand Shankara's view that the individual self is neither being nor not. I mean, the Supreme Being is neither, Supreme Brahman is neither being. But how can my Atman be neither being nor not being? He says, before you take a body, before you're either a woman or a man, these are all upadhis, then it is asat. It is not being in the human world. And when it takes on individual bodies, then it is being in the human world, but that is not the final goal of the individual Atman, so you can say it's not even existing. So neither being nor non-being in that sense. See how he has understood the text to support Vishishtadvaita, a personal God, by just breaking up the Sanskrit in different ways from Shankara and using the Gita to support his view. Shankara does that all the time. Okay, so now what is the conclusion? So when someone writes the Bhagavad Gita as it is, which is the name of the book of Swami Prabhupada, who claims to give you the true interpretation of the Gita. Who is a Vaishnava? Who is a Paurushya? Who is therefore a believer in a personal God? He acknowledges Ramanuja as part of his lineage. What is he doing? He's a very good Sanskritist. He's perfectly aware of what he's saying. On what grounds can he say it? What do you think? How do you come to, can you ever come therefore to a correct interpretation or understanding of the Gita? Or must it forever remain ambiguous so that you'd say, I don't know what the Gita is saying. Now it's your turn to tell me.
It depends on the filter from which you read.
Very good. Say more.
You want me to keep going?
Yes, keep going.
No, because he's clearly no two sets of experiences of the same event by two different people can be the same. In the same spirit, therefore, it is up to the reader, and he is catering to a particular type of reader.
So are you a formalist or non-formalist? Are texts meaning created?
I am formalist, I am non-formalist, and I don't know. All at the same time.
So he is saying, Ajay, is it Ajay? Ajay is saying that the interpretation of a text, what you accept depends on the filter of meaning that you accept. Acha. On what grounds do you accept this filter rather than that filter?
Personal beliefs.
Yeah, but the personal beliefs are not enough. I can believe the moon is made of green cheese. How do you think that I will follow this guru rather than that?
Relevance.
Uh-huh. Say more. Say more.
That's the difficult piece to say.
Very good. Filter, very good. You could use the word at some point, faith. Right? Faith and reason. But what I want you to understand is, your faith can be different from another individual's faith. That doesn't make the other individual mad or bad. This is again my point. You have to cling on to your faith, and then through the relevance of that faith for your life, you can walk on it one step at a time to see if it gives your life meaning, purpose and relevance. Then you accept it. Remember my point of view. Truth has not only got a mathematical model. Your truth need not be my truth. But there are barriers, there are boundaries, aren't there? I'll give you a story. There was a fundamentalist, Christian fundamentalist, talking to a scientist. And for Christian fundamentalists, some kind of fundamentalist, the world was created in 4300 BC. 4300 BC, God created the world. So this scientist said, how then do you explain the fossils, the bones of the dinosaurs which we have found in the earth, which go back 50, 60, 70 million years. If the world was created in 4300 BC, only 6000 years from now, how can you explain the fossils through carbon dating which are 60, 70 million years old? No problem, said the fundamentalist. God created the world with the fossils in it. End of discussion. So there are barriers, there are boundaries where relevance no longer applies. Once you start believing in those, the question is to set those boundaries, to set those barriers. And we have to see from our own experience and from the knowledge systems around us. The point about religion is that it must fit into the knowledge systems, other knowledge systems around us. You can't shut yourself off from scientific knowledge systems, mathematical knowledge systems, epistemic knowledge systems in your own little island of belief and say, that is only the thing that's going to work. A religion has relevance if it helps you to live in the world in which you live in a integral way, joined up way. So your religious vision and faith, which I think is very important, must make sense of scientific discoveries, mathematical discoveries. It must somehow fit. So you must be able to take on board evolution. You must be able to take on board the fact that the Earth is 9 billion years old and still be a believer, still have faith. That's the kind of faith that is rational and sensible. If your faith is cut off from all the knowledge systems around you and challenges them in this way, as the fundamentalists did to the scientists, the relevance, where is the relevance? How does it help you to live in this world, as part of this world? That's my submission.
So polycentric and acentric in the realm of jigyasa.
Yes.
Jigyasa would be curiosity.
Yeah. Inquiry into knowledge.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, when you look at whether Shankara's interpretation, only one Brahman, ekameva dvitiyam, all this is ultimately maya and illusion, ultimately, only provisionally real, ultimately all the differentiation will vanish as mists in the noonday sun. This is one of his examples. That is one interpretation. And when you look at Ramanuja's interpretation, no, it is Dvaita. There is a God out there different from us. We may be very, very intimately dependent on God. We cannot exist without His will, without His agreement, consensus. You have to see where the relevance fits in. And both of them, and if finally you can try and make sense of both being somehow relevant, then the question of decision has to come in. But I want you to appreciate the fact that within boundaries, unlike the boundary of the fundamentalists and the scientists, that went beyond the boundaries of common sense, that within boundaries you cannot accuse the other person of being in bad faith or of being fools or of being vicious or something like that. You have to live and tolerate different interpretations. And generally Hindus are very good at this.
Did Ramanuja actually refer to Shankara?
He refers to Advaita, because Shankara was 300 years before him.
His
Shankara's view had progressed by his followers. But he attacked Advaita. Yeah, he's Sarpati. Anyone who follows Advaita, how can they say that there is only one reality, there is no personal God, there is no Ishvara and everything? Ultimately, I will glide away like a snake glides away from this view. Yeah.
Because even on a contemporary basis, I'm just going back to another example, Buddha was quite snooty about Mahavira and Ajivika and all that. He was rubbishing them.
And the Hindus had huge debates with the Baudhas, with the Buddhists. Huge debates with them. And the Buddhists with them. So, the history of Indian philosophy and theology is a history of debate, vivada, huge debate. And so, as I say, it gave Amartya Sen a bestseller. And augmented his income quite appreciably through the argumentative. If you read that book, The Argumentative Indian, 95% of the examples are Hindu. You may have a few examples from Islam. India, of course, Indian encompasses officially everyone who is part of the traditional Indian context.
No, the Indian is not a religious term.
Exactly.
But the foundations are...
Yes, but if you actually look at most of his examples, it should be the argumentative Hindu, but of course it's not politically correct to write that.
No, but that apart, the Indian lives within the context of a societal structure, a social structure that is built on the idea of what Hindu structure is, which is not a religious... structure by itself.
Yeah, I support. That's why it is officially a secular state.
Yeah. Yeah.
From what you were saying earlier about multi layers.
Yeah.
I remembered one thing I had in lecture. So if there's a kettle, and there's water boiling in the kettle, And someone asks, why is the water boiling? You would say, because the vibrations from the electricity and it's coming through, and therefore the water's heating. But at the same time, you could say, the water's boiling because I want a cup of tea. So therefore, we have a scientific level of discourse, we have a religious level of discourse. Within religion, we have the Shankara, the Advaita, the Nimbarka, the Madhvas. So there's this whole plurality of layers that we're living in, and we can't shut ourselves off just to scientism or religious.
That is the mature way of looking at a text, exactly what I'm trying to say. That is the mature way of looking at a great literary text. You cannot, they are inherently, up to a point, ambiguous. And you cannot disregard that and say, therefore, there can be only one interpretation which makes sense. There can be more than one interpretation which makes sense, and I've tried to indicate how that is the case, especially with Sanskrit texts, which have samasas and so on, which can be broken up in different ways. But all literary texts. And that is a mature way of looking at a text, and that generates an element of toleration. We can live together. In terms
just
of misunderstanding, just about.
What is the opposite of ambiguous? Then it has multiple meanings.
Clarity.
Multiple meanings. You should come up with another polycentric.
Come up. Now, don't ask me difficult questions, especially before I have my cha in the evening. Yeah, but my basic message has got through, right? About the way you approach a text. And you are quite right. I'm a formalist, a non-formalist, and up to a point, I don't know. You are also right. Relevance is so important in handling the meaning of a text, because it has to fit in into other dimensions of knowledge, which is what you're saying. So I think that if that point has got through to you, and this is just an example, an exercise of how it can happen, then we can live with each other with different interpretations. We can believe our interpretation is the better one, is the truer one, but you cannot say, as long as there's relevance and as long as there's good faith, as long as it can be shown, you cannot say the opponent is a fool, or mine is the only way, or the opponent is in bad faith, or something like that. You have to learn to live with these. And that's how we operate in this world. We negotiate meaning. We negotiate meaning to some extent. And to insist in this way is unhelpful. And it can reach a point of being immoral also.
It's a strength and a weakness in my eyes.
Yes. How is it a strength?
A strength that you can incorporate multiple views of.
Yes.
Meaning of this text.
Yes.
Weakness, like in other religions, they're very rigid, very fixed. So everybody knows which way, which path to follow.
This way or the highway.
Well, in our religion, we have multiple views, and we say, well, if you want to follow your path, that's fine. If you want to follow your path, it's fine.
We don't quite say that. We say if you want to follow your path, you'll eventually come to mind, but I'm holding my nose like this, and you are going to hold your nose like that, but eventually you'll hold. Because we do say that in Hinduism. But also, if you look at Christianity now, look at all the denominations. They interpret the Bible I'm not even looking at the fundamentalists. You look at the Anglicans, the Roman Catholics, look at Islam. You've also got different interpretations of the Quran. Which text supersedes the other text? There's one text in the Quran which says, if you meet an idolater, kill him. And I had an exercise once with Muslims, where I was teaching a class where there were a number of Muslims, and I gave them an exercise. They brought up this text, and they said, look, this is one text of the Quran. If you see idolaters, because all Hindus are idolaters, right? Murti puja and so on, kill him. And then they brought out different texts from the Quran which superseded or contradicted that. And they said, if you focus only on that one text, that will legitimate violence. But if you bring out, this was in Singapore, in the 10% Muslims there, but if you bring out these other texts from the Quran, it goes against this and it helps you to live in peace. So you cannot take this in isolation. So even the Muslims now are beginning to go that direction. Christians are doing it. Buddhists have done it for generations and centuries. Hindus, our past masters, are doing it. So it's strength and weakness in a sense. Okay, I'm afraid I have to stop talking now. But thank you very much for your
attention.
Thank you. I'm sorry I'm getting late.